First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Donate or discard? Good morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, what will the Duval County Public Schools do with all of the books they've been forced to take off library and classroom shelves? We go inside a JAGS Today investigation in just a bit, and you can call us right now. It's 549-2937. Then later, hurricane season is here. How can solar power help fill in the energy grid in the coming years to make sure we keep all of our lights on? That and more all ahead. But first this morning, a conundrum. Should they donate or discard all those books? The Duval County Public Schools says it's not sure yet what to do with thousands of books they've had to pull over content concerns. This is in regard to a controversial new state law. And some librarians and teachers in Duval schools say they haven't gotten much guidance about whether they should donate or toss unapproved books. All this as school districts across the state are wrestling with how to implement new rules in Florida, making it easier for the public to contest school books. Claire Heddles of JAGS Today has been looking into this and joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And we want your calls. What are your questions about this? Amid revelations that a lot of discarded books taken off shelves, well, could they be shredded? Could they be donated? What do you think? 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJags. All right. So you decided to look into this because you were hearing from educators that they weren't sure what to do with all of these books, right?
Right. Kind of twofold, too. I'd heard from some teachers that weren't quite sure what to do, and I'd heard from parents who were getting books, bags of books from their kids' schools that they were sending home. And then some media specialists were telling me that they were under the impression that the books were being sent to a recycling center. So for the past few months, we've been trying to collect records to figure out just how many books have been pulled from shelves and what exactly is happening to them. And there's a few different categories of books that are being pulled. One sort of less publicized aspect of this new Florida law that makes it easier for parents to contest books, but also limits content that can be in books, is also to maintain an updated library collection.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the books that are being pulled are old and outdated, and media specialists tell me they really didn't have time to weed their collections of these old and outdated books in recent years because they're stretched so thin already. So part of the books that are being pulled are probably ones that should have been pulled or that are old or maybe even moldy. So there's a lot of books that are being pulled because the librarians, you know, finally have this dedicated time or are being forced to spend the dedicated time going through their library collections. But there's also some book advocates that are worried that controversial books are being pulled from library shelves and sent with the old and outdated books without the public forum. Duval Schools says controversial books are going before public debate, and those are being put in a separate pile, and they're looking for organizations to donate them to. They said they haven't established, but they're planning to donate the books that are being pulled for content. But then we looked at how many books had been sent to the recycling center. So we looked at payment logs from the recycling center that the district uses. This recycling center pays for textbooks, but they don't pay to recycle library books, but they'll take them for free. And we saw that this year, since last July, over the past year, the district has recycled about 60 tons of library books. That's about twice as many as they recycled last year. Many of those, based on the logs we've seen, are likely these old and outdated books. But there are some concerns that controversial books are also being pulled this way.
549-2937. You did speak with a teacher who asked to remain anonymous. She posted a notice on social media offering up the books she had to pull from her classroom library. She says during the last week of school, she was told to either discard, donate, or store any books that had not been approved.
Right. So there's also this sort of connected and separate issue of the classroom libraries. So we have the school librarians going through the media center, the libraries for the schools, And then the Florida Department of Education expanded Florida law to apply to classroom libraries, which teachers have collected over the years via donations, or they've bought books or brought them from home for kids to read in the classroom. Now, there is a legal challenge right now to the part of the Florida Department of Education rule applying the law to classroom libraries. We're expecting a ruling on that later this month. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, the districts have gone ahead and applied to the law to classroom libraries. And so teachers were telling me that during the last week of school year, any books that hadn't been approved yet, they either had to keep in storage, give away, or toss or get rid of. And most of the books, this teacher I spoke to said, none of the books in her classroom library came back as officially non-approved, but they were either not approved for the grade level that she was teaching, because part of the law and part of the way that Duval Schools is carrying it out is that they're assigning each book a grade level. So she's saying students in her classrooms might not be able to read more advanced books because now they're limited by grade level, or they just hadn't been reviewed yet. There's mm-hmm. over a million books across the district, and they thus far have approved about 100,000 as of mid-May.
So only 1/10 of the pulled books have been put back on shelves. Is that right?
Based on the latest number that we've gotten from the district, about 100,000, that's about a little less than a tenth of the number of books that they've said that they have district-wide are ones that have been approved so far. Teachers say that they've been told to scan their books using a scanner and see if it's one of the ones that's been approved. If not, they have to keep them in storage, and they could wait until next year, or they could just give the books away in the meantime.
So to be clear, there isn't evidence that the widespread shedding or recycling of books on the state's list is happening, but there are concerns that some of those books could meet that fate. Is that fair to say?
Sort of. And I will say the state has said multiple times they don't have a list. They don't have a specific list of books that you can't have. They have guidelines for what kinds of books you can't have, and then it's down to the media specialists to make those lists. So right now, Duval Schools has a list of about 20 books that's on their official not approved list that is currently undergoing review. Tomorrow evening, for example, there's a public meeting about the book The Kite Runner. That's one of those on the reviewed non-approved list.
Public meeting where?
At the district headquarters.
At the district headquarters. Mm-hmm. A meeting specifically about The Kite Runner?
Yes, they have this book reconsideration committee. So those that want to participate in the discussion about what books should be approved or whether or not a book should be approved, those are the meetings they can attend. There's one tomorrow night. I think it's at 5 at district headquarters. That one's specifically about The Kite Runner, but different books that parents have contested will be up for public forum in coming months.
And why is The Kite Runner being contested?
I am not sure of the details at the moment. I think there was a parent challenge about inappropriate content, and I think that's what's being debated.
It's a New York Times bestseller looking at Afghanistan before and after the Taliban. And so let's go to your calls. It's 549-2937. Brian in Mandarin. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. Go ahead.
So I was calling in because earlier this month I noticed that there was 30,000, but they listed that they had approximately 30,000 books that they had approved list. But then 2 weeks later, they updated their list to 108,000. So they all of a sudden over a 2 week period were able to approve books at a 49 second time frame. So there's something going on with the numbers. They're only at about 7% of the books removed in the district. And there's a school board meeting tonight, and I encourage people to make sure that the conversation isn't about the new superintendent, but what they're going to do to get books back into the school.
Thanks for that. I'm sure there'll be a lot of people coming out to this because, as he mentioned, the interim superintendent will be chairing her first meeting, and there's this new investigation by you at jackstoday.org on the books.
Dana Krisnar, right, our new interim superintendent, who was formerly deputy superintendent. This will be her first meeting as acting superintendent tonight.
549-2937, what are your questions about book removals and what the district might do with the books? Donate them? Discard them? Hold them in storage? Wendy in Putnam County. Hello, Wendy.
Yes, ma'am. I'm a retired teacher, so I can say what I want to now without any danger of. But if I were teaching right now, teaching middle school, like I had in my last school for 20 years, I had the second largest library on campus besides the library. And I took all of her discard books. I took any book that I could ever get, and I put it on the shelves. Most of them I had read. I had Flowers for Algernon on my middle school shelf. I had Fahrenheit 451. I had To Kill a Mockingbird. I had a lot of books that they're talking about putting on this list or that they're already on the list. Don't shred these books. Please give them to senior centers. Donate them to kids who want to read them. I know that when I retired, I had to purge my libraries. And imagine the glee when the kids said, I can take any book that I want from your shelves. I said, yeah. I said, and a lot of them had recommendations. I had kids read books and write little recommendations in front of them, like give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down, 5 stars, 1 star, whatever. You know, kids want to read, and if you keep them from reading, you're keeping them from getting educated, Mr. Ron DeSantis. Excuse me, sorry, got political there. That's it. I'll take any comments off the air.
That's a retired teacher, Wendy, calling from Putnam County, Florida, Claire Heddles.
I think to both the caller's points, both Brian and Wendy, there is concern that there's simply going to be less books in the classrooms and in school libraries because they're pulling books on that are older, outdated. They're pulling books based on grade level, reading appropriateness, potentially to a larger extent than might be necessary. And so I think there's concern from teachers that there's simply just going to be less books and less opportunities for students to find a book they love, to fall in love with reading, to read advanced books, to challenge their brains when they're reading.
And to be clear, as you've previously reported at jackstoday.org, Duval County Public Schools pulled this many books to protect teachers, they said, they told you, from running afoul of new state laws.
Right.
Right?
Right. And the governor has done these whole press conferences trying to say that there are no books banned in Florida, that we do have evidence that there are books being pulled. There are lists of books that are currently not approved or that are undergoing review.
If they're not banned, they're not available. It's a de facto ban, in other words, to split a few hairs. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And he pointed to Duval Schools and said, you know, Duval Schools is trying to make a bigger issue than it is. What Duval Schools has responded repeatedly is that they're doing everything they can to follow state law and that they're trying to protect teachers from potential punishments on their education licenses for having unreviewed books because, you know, that's the punishment for not following this law, that every book in media centers have been approved by a certified media specialist. It could result in punishment from the Office of Professional Practices on teachers' teaching licenses. So the district is saying, we're doing this comprehensive review to protect our staff.
No teacher wants to be face charges or have their teaching license pulled. But we are hearing from a lot of retired teachers and teachers anonymously telling us they're not happy with what's happening. And we want your calls. It's 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts. Lots of tweets. Here's one. Aren't residents of this state exhausted yet? My tax dollars paid for those books, and I don't even have kids in the Duval schools. Discarding good books because it offends certain people like Moms for Liberty is wrong. Here's another tweet. At minimum, they should give Duval County residents first pick at those books so that those who want them for their kids can get them. Our tax dollars paid for them. Mandy tweets the show. Many teachers bought the books out of their own pockets for classroom libraries. Is DCPS going to donate or discard books that weren't theirs to begin with? What about that?
So on the school level and the teacher level, it's really case by case basis based on the teachers that I've talked to that are deciding to send books home with students. If they're books that they're pulling for being old or outdated, then they're sending them home with kids. Mm-hmm. So I think that's sort of case by case. The district's official policy, and that's mainly for books being pulled from school libraries, it seems is that they send some of the old and outdated ones to recycling, and they have told me that they're holding inappropriate ones, looking for an organization to donate. I think when I asked media specialists about this policy, they said that policy wasn't really communicated to them at any point, and as they're pulling books, they're not necessarily sorting them as ones that are being pulled for being not approved yet and ones that are being pulled for being old and outdated. So there's some confusion about how that is actually going to happen, but the district is saying that books that are pulled for violations with Florida law or inappropriateness will be donated. They're not going to be shredded. Old and outdated books are the ones that they say are the ones that are in this 60 tons of books this year that were sent to the recycling center.
Lots of people emailing the show begging teachers and school librarians not to get rid of a single book, to keep them so that they can be returned back to shelves as soon as possible. Here's one from another listener. If a book is so pornographic that the media can't even show it on their website, recycle those books. The others can be moved to age-appropriate school libraries. Now, the governor did give a press conference where he pointed out some examples of content in books that he defined as pornographic and said they should not be available to kids. Educators and freedom of expression groups pushed back against that and said he had cherry-picked a few examples. But you've looked at that. What about this?
And the few books that the governor has pointed out as having issues with, I think, were mostly graphic novels, and he was using the Florida law about pornography, expanding it to include these depictions in graphic novels. But none of those books have been found in Duval schools, to my knowledge. And so those specific books that the governor took issue with really aren't the issue in Duval schools, I don't think.
Were they found anywhere in Florida schools?
There were a few. I think the governor published a list of where some of these books were found.
Okay. But none in Duval County
but
schools.
But here, no, those specific books that had graphic novels or depictions of sexual content that the governor is defining as pornographic weren't found here.
549-2937. Give us a call. Bill in Lakewood. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for this discussion. I'm a retired teacher and grew up in an era where an awful lot of the books that I think are considered mind-bending or pornographic now were considered fine literature. But I want to, and when we read them all, and so far as I know, it didn't damage me. I think the numbers on this are going to matter a lot. I'm imagining that if thousands of books are removed and we don't carefully catalog which ones were removed for what reason, moldy versus pornographic. This will be the next talking point. Presidential campaign coming up, I can imagine certain politicians saying 50,000 books were found to be blah, 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 and removed from shelves. So I'm sorry for the school district's burden. There aren't enough teachers. There aren't enough staff. There isn't enough money to do all this counting and documentation, but it's going to be very important to document which books and how many were removed for what reason.
Thank you, Bill.
Yeah, I think he makes a good point that it really has put a heavy load on the district and definitely on the media specialists, the ones I've talked to. It's their regular duties. I mean, they teach classes, they maintain the collection and maintain the libraries. And this book review has taken up a lot of their time in recent months. And so that's been a heavy load for the district in order to comply with this law. And I think part of the confusion that we're hearing from teachers and media specialists is because it is such a massive operation to sort through more than a million books, implement new software to sort and catalog them. And it sounds like the software at different points crashes, and so it's sort of complicated for these media specialists to comply, and they can't always tell if another media specialist has approved a book. And so it's this massive load for the district to try to comply with this law over what might be just a few books, but out of concern of whether or not they would run afoul of the law, it's this huge undertaking.
Chris tweets the show, the governor and Florida Republicans are banking on districts like Duval over complying with book removal laws. This is by design. It invites a gentle complicity where school administrators can hide their cowardice behind claims they are protecting teachers rather than banning books. The district disputes that characterization, saying they're simply trying to comply with the law as it's been laid out. Peter tweets the show, "Our legislature bends over backwards for the Second Amendment, but not the First Amendment. We should point out Penguin Random House, five authors from Penguin, Florida parents, and an advocacy group have sued, alleging that removing books from Florida schools that discuss race and LGBTQ people is a violation of the First Amendment." That lawsuit filed last month. And so this whole matter will end up in the courts. It already is. That's something to track.
Right. We're expecting a ruling mid-June in this administrative legal challenge that was the state's largest teachers union, alongside the group Florida Freedom to Read and a parents and teachers group that brought this legal challenge against the Florida Department of Education, specifically about the law applying to classroom libraries, because that's part of what's created such a heavy load, is that media specialists now have been approving books in classroom libraries. The court kicked off Florida Freedom to Read and the parents group. Now it's just the teachers union versus the Department of Education, because the court decided that only the teachers union had standing, but it'll rule later this month as to whether that law will keep applying to classroom libraries.
Julie tweets the show, "Put the books removed for content back on the shelves and let the chips fall where they may. It's one thing to spout off garbage at a school board meeting, quite another to find an attorney who will argue before a judge that Pulitzer Prize winners should be pulled." What about this? People out there egging on teachers, I shouldn't say egging on, but encouraging teachers and principals to defy this law and stand for free literary expression.
And I think maybe not defy. I think there are people that are saying, wait until it's challenged. Why are we reviewing all books ahead of time when there hasn't been a parental challenge to every single one of these books? The law does provide for a public forum and discussion if a parent challenges a book, and then a determination as to whether or not it will stay on shelves. But I think there are some people that are frustrated that this whole review is happening of every book, even as they haven't been challenged. The district says that protects teachers, but I think there are some people that say, let the book stay, see if they're challenged, and then that can be worked out in court. And, you know, part of the fears are around the punishment that the state said would come with not complying with the law. One, the anti-pornography law that holds a felony charge, I think has some people concerned that how expansive is that law going to be interpreted? And then the potential punishment for having an unreviewed book, of it impacting your teaching license. So I think there's sort of confusion and fear as to how they, you know, what will happen to teachers that have unreviewed books. But we haven't heard of anyone actually being arrested for books in the classroom yet. There's sort of fears abounding right now.
Sue in Mandarin. Hello, Sue.
Good morning. Well, I'm really troubled by the fact that we're not talking about the availability of violence on TV. I could turn the TV on right now in the middle of the morning and find stuff that kids should not certainly watch. A book that they can get out of the library from a librarian is a whole nother matter. And somebody will answer questions, and a parent can answer a question about the content of the book. But to pull things off the shelf without any challenges to the idea of book banning and removal is really troubling. It is a reversal right back to terribly repressive times.
Thank you, Sue. So all of these concerns are certain to come up tonight at the school board meeting on the South Bank. Tell us more about what we might expect there tonight.
There's a discussion on budget, next year's budget, during the school board meeting. There's nothing about books officially on the agenda, so it might come up during public comment, but there's not a vote on books. There is, however, a meeting tomorrow about, as I mentioned earlier, specifically the book The Kite Runner, and there's future meetings you can see on Duval County's general meeting notice portion of their website, also about other books on this review list of that have been contested by parents for those that want to get involved in discussions about what books should stay in schools. And then the deadline, I think, for the district to sort of comply with this law is July 1st. July 1st each year, the superintendent has to certify that a media specialists have all been trained and have selected the books in the libraries.
Claire Heddles, thank you for joining us. And you can read more of the reporting on this issue at our own jackstoday.org. Thanks, Claire.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, Untold Stories returns to the Florida Theater. But up next, can more solar power provide backup relief during hurricane season? After this. Welcome back. Well, it's June, and once again, Florida is staring down the barrel at another hurricane season. Jacksonville has been looking at ways to make this community and its power grid more resilient in the face of storms. Now, one solution involves what's known as distributed energy resources, and solar power is part of that. Heaven Campbell is on the line. She's the Florida Program Director for Solar United Neighbors, and as we talk hurricane season, Heaven, it's good to have you.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me, Melissa.
All right, so it's time to prepare for several named storms this season in Florida once again. And you recently have been writing about this, calling for making the power grid in Florida cities more resilient by investing in technologies like solar and batteries. Tell us more about how this might work and what you're envisioning it over at Solar United Neighbors.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, you know, we're always advocating for protecting net metering. So protecting the financial mechanism that makes solar energy affordable for families. We want to make sure that families are able to go solar so that we have customer-owned and distributed solar throughout our grid, because that makes us more resilient. We need some resilience hubs as well, but having solar on our neighbors' homes, that's hyper-local. And then we're able to see neighbors reaching out and helping one another. Just like I wrote about recently in the Times Union, we, you know, shared a story of Frank Hardy opening his home in Naples area to be able to store his neighbor's insulin and keep it cold whenever he had power still after Hurricane Ian, because he had solar and battery backup. So definitely protecting net metering is top of mind. And then after that, investing in battery incentives and other ways to help produce this hyper-local resilience.
So where are we now? Because it's my understanding the current grid is nowhere near where you're envisioning it to be.
Absolutely. I think that we're on the way. So we are developing some resilience hubs throughout Florida. UCF is leading one just here in Central Florida and Orange County. So we're seeing some universities step up and lead different resilience hubs in South Florida. That's happening as well. But we also need to be encouraging and supporting, like I said, our neighbors to be investing in solar, and then, you know, maybe developing some type of way that we can signal, hey, I'm a neighbor that has solar and battery backup, and I'm willing to let my, you know, my other neighbors come and charge their devices or store their medicine at my house in these times of need.
Now, what's the role of the legislature in all of this? You're arguing they need to find more pathways to make solar and battery storage more widely available and also protect policies like net metering. This is a body of lawmakers that is heavily under the sway of investor-owned utilities, which have come under criticism for making this pathway to more solar and battery storage more difficult for the individual consumer. So what about that?
That's right. They really have a protective role to play that they haven't been playing right now. Luckily, some of our local lawmakers here in Northeast Florida are on the right side and are, you know, thinking about how we can protect these policies, and then some aren't. So we want them to protect net metering. That's something that they failed to do. We had to depend on a governor veto in order to stop the unraveling of this consumer prosumer policy, if you will. And then we also want them to protect public power. So having, you know, locally owned power like municipal utilities is a way that we can directly participate in policies. So we saw some attacks on municipal utilities that didn't move completely forward during the last session that were widespread. And then we also saw some local attacks like Gainesville, for example, that did move forward. So that's a really dangerous and scary precedent, and we don't want that to happen because we want to protect that public power.
Susan tweets the show, net metering means that the energy producer wants to sell their produced energy at retail instead of wholesale. When will residential solar be competitive so that they can sell their electricity at wholesale, like solar farms, she asks. Having any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so net metering is this fair policy, and we actually view it not so much as a sell, but a credit for kilowatt hours that are being shared back by the utility to your neighbor. So you don't really have control over that sell. The utility is selling it to your neighbor after you share it back to them. So it's just a fair credit on your bill for that, you know, kilowatt hours, that energy that you've already shared. At the small scale, this is not a wholesale power generation like a solar farm. And that's not something that we think that residents need to be doing in Florida. The utilities are doing that. That's great. It's a tool in the toolbox. But whenever you have a small scale PV system or solar system on your home, you're connected to the grid. Your extra power is going to flow right back to the grid no matter what you do. So getting a fair credit on your bill is the only thing that makes sense.
Daryl in St. Augustine. Hey, Daryl, what are your thoughts about solar power and storm season?
Yes. Good morning, Alyssa. Great show. I just see a pattern here of big government taking control of our lives, and the big government is in Tallahassee. You know, they're controlling what our kids read. They're controlling what teachers teach. So, you know, a professional librarian can't be a librarian, and a teacher can't be a teacher, even though they're the professional. We're letting the politicians control everything, and the power of the big government in Tallahassee, now they're controlling what electricity you have. You know, frankly, DeSantis represents big government control.
Daryl, thanks for the call. Heaven, should government get out of the way? To quote a Republican talking point from years past, and I'll let the sun shine in on more solar for more people in Florida.
Absolutely. And you're right. That is, as you put it, a Republican talking point, because solar is completely bipartisan. People love solar, and polls have shown time and time again that there is broad, widespread majority support for solar from all Floridians, no matter where you fall. If you're a Democrat, Republican, independent, Floridians just love solar. It's our private property rights. You know, people come to this for so many different reasons. The main one that we see is economic, because it is an economic mechanism for investment with a good rate of return, and then resilience. So absolutely, everybody loves solar, and they should get out of the way, because this is our right to power our homes how we please.
Heaven Campbell, she's the Florida Program Director for Solar United Neighbors. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Juneteenth is coming up, and to celebrate, the first ever Black Founders Forum is coming to the UNF campus next week. This high-profile conference brings together Black entrepreneurs, investors, and innovators from across the region. And they will compete. Five companies will be selected to pitch their idea to a live audience with a big venture capital stake up for grabs. Jim Stallings is CEO of PS27 Ventures and joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Oh, thank you. Always great to see you, Melissa.
All right. So tell us more about this Shark Tank style competition on the UNF campus at your Black Founders Forum.
Yeah, well, look, first, the event is sold out. I've never seen the demand for this type of program ever. So every seat, every booth, every exhibit table, we've expanded the venue at least a couple of times. It's now probably a fire hazard to get all the people in. But what we have as a center of this is we've invited 30 entrepreneurs from across the United States, different technologies, different mm-hmm. solutions, different individuals, men and women, mm-hmm. all different stages of development of their company. They're the center of this. They're in a room in an area we call the showcase. The other thing we've brought together is dozens of venture capital investors, angel investors, institutional investors, VC firms from across the Southeast and in some cases across the country. And what our goal is to bring these entrepreneurs in contact with investors. Many of them told me years ago, Jim, I've never had a chance to work with a VC, an investor. Yeah. I've never had a chance to have a good dialogue. In some cases, I've been not viewed as ready for that. So our goal is to bring them together, and we're going to have a little bit of what I call VC madness. VC madness. They're going to flood the zone. They're going to have lots of conversations, lots of meetings, lots of interaction. And we're hoping these entrepreneurs will learn from this. They'll gain not just an education, but they'll also get an investment.
This is so important because doesn't the data show that the vast majority of venture capital funding goes to white male startups, led startups?
Yeah,
guys get most of the funding.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary when you look at the numbers. I mean, if you just look at last quarter in the United States of America, $158 billion of venture capital went out to startups. Less than 2% of that went to people of color. If you in women, it's 1.3%. So the goal here is not so much to change all of that, but it's to give these young entrepreneurs an opportunity to learn, to grow. And somebody's going to walk away with $250,000. It's a chance to teach, learn, gain confidence, but also gain capital, because this is really about the American dream. And that has always been, if you've got a big idea, if you're willing to work really, really hard, and if you can garner the partnership of someone with capital to help you with your vision, it could turn into one of the greatest companies in America. And that's really the story of some of the big companies we read about every single day. They started just like that. So we want to create a program that will do that for these young entrepreneurs.
Now, your keynote speaker is Carla Harris, senior client advisor at Morgan Stanley and a Jacksonville native. She's a big draw in and of herself.
Yeah, Carla is one of the most powerful women on Wall Street.
Yeah.
She started in Jacksonville. She climbed the ladder, went to Harvard. She's just, one of the most senior executives on the street today. She knows a lot about financial capital. So we've asked her to come to town and share her journey, her story about how she did it. But more importantly, talk about the leadership you need. If you're an entrepreneur, what does it take beyond just passion? What's the knowledge? What are the skills? Who are the mentors? She's going to share that view with these entrepreneurs. By the way, there are going to be hundreds of other people listening to her, and we know they'll gain from her knowledge and wisdom. She's got a new book out. She's going to take some time and share the insights from the book. But she's a great example of just how far you can go with a little bit of help and a lot of passion and energy.
And, of course, you are doing the Black Founders Forum in celebration of Juneteenth.
Yeah, it's the week of Juneteenth. Mm-hmm. We decided to do it at that time because there's a lot of attention on what can we do? What can we celebrate? What can we do to celebrate the culture, the African-American heritage in America? We thought it was just a great venue. We've never done a Black Founders Forum before. The other thing we're going to have here is we're going to have the Shark Tank. And the goal is to get people on stage in front of 350 people.
And pitch their idea.
And they're gonna, you know, it's going to be a lot like the TV show.
Wow. And who are the, is there a panel of judges?
We'll have a panel of four judges. Mm-hmm. The crowd is going to have an opportunity to weigh in. There'll be a large QR code on the screen. At the end of the five pitches, they'll scan that in. They have a big vote, the four judges. So we have five voters in this. And they'll collaborate and commiserate for a bit and come up with the winner. So we're looking forward to handing out a big check at the end.
You've developed this over the years, and you have provided funding to a slew of companies, including some local companies.
Yeah.
Yes, and we so have. That's got to be pretty satisfying for you personally.
Yeah. You know, the great joy in all of this is these entrepreneurs get, if they're given an opportunity, if they're in an environment that's positive and fertile with knowledge and wisdom and money, it can change their life. And we've seen companies from 10 years ago that have not only grown financially, they've created jobs, they've paid taxes, they're giving back to the community, they're doing positive things for other companies, they're mentoring other entrepreneurs that are coming now. It's an ecosystem. It's really a flywheel effect that happens. It's all happening right here in Jacksonville. We're very proud to be in the middle of it. So next week, our goal is to do it again with mm-hmm. a big audience, with a big group, and hopefully get one of these founders to go off and we read about them one day.
Read about them one day. Yeah. Thanks to you. We tell people where this is, but as you said, it's sold out.
It's sold out. Yeah.
Which is so exciting.
Yeah, it really is. And this is the earliest we've ever had any venues sell out. We've got people now mad at me because they're having to be on a wait list, but it shows there's demand and interest. We've got incredible sponsors and supporters. I have never seen just the overwhelming support from companies. We've invited veterans to the program. We got a special section for them. We've got high schoolers coming. We've got young college students coming. They all want to witness this paradigm, this how the American dream happens right here, where you bring capital and passion and energy together. And I'm so happy to be a part of it.
Well, congrats, Jim. He's Jim Stallings, CEO of PS27 Ventures. It's sold out, the Black Founders Forum next week on the UNF campus. Have fun.
Thank you.
And when we come back, how you can get tickets to another cool event, Untold Stories, at the Florida Theater. That's next.
Life South Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with Life South helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
Join me, Dr. Joe Servin, for What's Health Got to Do With It, a weekly program that examines where and how healthcare intersects with your daily life. Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 9 p.m. on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, the impact of the Supreme Court's conservative supermajority on American life. We'll speak with Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice, about critical decisions on abortion rights, gun safety, and environmental regulation. His new book is called The Supermajority, How the Supreme Court Divided America. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
A new PR campaign from the Biden administration for the American public to see that they're enforcing the law by showing people what happens to migrants who come through the U.S. southern border without authorization.
We had media events at the airports to observe some deportation flights and to film what was happening.
Rebranding U.S. border policies next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
Baseball's playing by new rules. Games are now shorter. There's more drama on the diamond. But fans of the major leagues are paying a price. I mean, $8 for a hot dog? Come on. There is another way. Next time on 1A, we hear why the minor leagues are having their moment.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, it's an amazing series at the Florida Theater that honors the tradition of oral storytelling, but in a modern context. Untold Stories showcases six local storytellers featuring personal and transformative tales on the Florida theater stage. And a new round is coming up. It's the new season of Untold Stories, curated by artistic director Barbara Colicello of Babs Lab. She joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also here, one of the storytellers, Nathan Ballantyne, also known as the Man in Overalls. Good to see you.
Good morning. Good morning.
All right. We'll hear your story in a bit, Nathan. But first, Barbara, Untold Stories is back June 8th, Florida Theater. And the theme is A Fork in the Road. Interesting.
Yes. I always get to pick the themes. And I like to pick themes that conjure up many different things for people. And so the stories are reflecting that this time. And this is exciting. It's the last of the evening of the second season.
Mm-hmm.
And I can feel it in my bones. The audience is really big. Tickets are really selling. And the word is out that these evenings are intimate and fun and interesting. And you just don't know what you're going to get.
So that brings me to you, Man in Overalls. What are we going to get from your talk on stage at the Florida Theater?
Sure. I'm telling some stories about family. My grandfather, little sneak peek, is that my grandfather wore overalls every day of his life. And that's some of part of the story about how I came into my overalls.
Was he a farmer?
He was a farmer.
So was my grandpa.
And oh, yeah.
He wore overalls every day of his life, too.
Yep.
Yeah.
There you go.
Whenever I see you, I think of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so you're going to talk about him?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about him. I'm going to talk about my mother some, and then how my mom helped me get started gardening. And then some of the stories along the way that led to this neighborhood farm model that we have, our unlimited urban U-Pick, where folks are able to come and pick whatever they want whenever they please. And that way, as farmers, we don't have to go to market, and folks don't have to wait for market day. They can kind of get what they want. So it's kind of telling all the backstory on how that model emerged and things like that.
So what was your personal fork in the road?
Oh,
we can't give
that away. Okay.
You have to come and listen.
Got to come and listen. But you've got five other speakers on stage telling their big choice they faced in their life.
Yeah. And some of, you know, it's funny when you're working with people, they'll be saying things and I'll say, well, that was a fork in the road. And then they'll go, you know, a little more, well, that was a fork in the road. And people realize that there are a lot of little decisions that lead up to that time where you say, okay, I'm going to be really decisive mm-hmm. and make a decision that does really affect the rest of your life.
Now, this is the last big event at the theater, isn't it, before they close down for some renovations?
Yes. Yes. It's really exciting. So, the Florida Theater, as beautiful as it is going to get perked up, and chandeliers and walls, all that beautiful woodwork is all being cleaned and refinished and painted. And so that's exciting. But we hope to be back for a third season.
Oh, yeah, of course. Now, you've mentioned this before on the show, but can you maybe explain again? How'd you come up with this idea?
Well, I'm a big believer in the power of story, like many others. And when you sit in a room in a story circle and you exchange some shared experiences or some history, you immediately feel like you know that person. It's a window into their soul. And so this is expanding on that idea. Numa Cicilline heard it from our sponsors. The Wolfberg Foundation, they had seen something in Alaska, and it's like it. Numa just said, why can't we do this at Florida mm-hmm. Theater? I love the idea, because where else to do a story series in one of the most storied buildings in Jacksonville.
Sure.
So we just started it and decided to make it quarterly. And
here we are.
And here we are.
I love, so Barbara and I were just talking outside a few minutes ago about how storytelling is this humanizer. There's so much of our lives that we lead where we're either the served or the serving. And when you share stories with people, then you're just human. Mm-hmm. And that's a really beautiful chance. And whether you're listening to the story or telling the story, it's a very humanizing experience. So I love it for that reason.
Have you ever done anything like this before?
I facilitated a gathering once a month in Tallahassee called College and Cornbread. And it was gathering of folks that all who were working on issues of food. And we always started our meetings with a extended introduction. Our introductions took 45 minutes. And we would ask some question like, what is a family recipe? Or what's your food dream? Or what have you been working on related to food recently? And so not to the degree of, you know, full stories, but lots of snippets like that. And it was a beautiful time.
Wow. Well, get your tickets now. Not many left, I don't think, for Untold Stories, A Fork in the Road, Thursday night, 7:30 p.m. at the Florida Theater with six local storytellers on stage, including Nathan Ballantyne, the man in overalls. He will come and do your garden for you right at your house and do a great job. Check his company out. And Barbara Colicello curating this amazing series. Thanks so much for telling us a little bit about the stories.
Sure.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. And thanks for listening. To our storytelling team, David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Isabella Da Silva, Michelle Corum, Courtney Jackson on phones today, and I'm Melissa Ross. This is WJCT News, 89.9 Jacksonville. Make it a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.